Hi, my name is Laura. I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon, and I call the Early Risers Al-Anon Family Group in Birmingham the best group in Birmingham and my home group. Thank you very much for asking me to be here. Thank you, Milton, for getting in touch with me. Thank you, Jim and Gloria, for letting me follow you up here, leading me here. And for all the trustees, y'all do a great job here. This is the first time I've been here, and this is really a great place. I can see why you all come back again and again. Come on in. What I was asked to do is to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me now. I am the oldest of three, and my siblings are a little closer together than Mary was talking about last night. I was born in Birmingham, and my father was in school, and my mother was an elementary school teacher, and my sister is very close in age to me, and I learned very, very, very early that I was supposed to help take care of everybody and everything. And I lived up to that expectation. I had a pretty uneventful childhood. You know, I lived in a nice home with good parents. There was no alcoholism in our family. I do know now that my parents have been affected by all sorts of similar diseases. But basically, I had a pretty normal, you know, pretty average childhood. So a lot of the traits that I came to adulthood with were not the result of alcoholism. They were just what I got. You know, I had a lot of those same traits that are stereotypical of the first child. You know, I tried to be perfect and achieve and meet everybody's expectations. I was supposed to be the leader on all of that. And I also was very bossy. And that goes with the territory, right? I can remember being the leader in the little neighborhood whenever we get together and play games and do whatever, as long as they did what I told them to do. We had a wonderful time. And I was very good at it. I was very, very good at it. When I was about 9, we moved to a small town. And but I got along real well with everybody. Everything was fine there. Graduated from high school and went to school in Tuscaloosa. And that's when I really came into my own. I learned how to use all of those little traits that I had picked up over time, and it wasn't long before I met a guy. And he was great. You know, he had all these things. He was like a mountain climber. And he did all these things that I was so terrified to do. And but I could hand that power right over to him. And I could take that all in and feel like I was somebody and I was something. So we dated and broke up, and we dated and we broke up, and we dated and we broke up, and he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. So that's what we did, and I thought everything was right on track. You know, I was graduating from college. I'd done all the little things in the little order that you're supposed to do them in. You know, I was filling up that checklist. I don't know where I got the checklist, you know, but it was a checklist that I had cobbled together that meant this is, you're doing the right thing. You know, you're doing the right thing. So we decided to get married, and I'm not really sure why, but we decided that we wouldn't tell anybody else until we talked to my parents. I think that was part of that little list of doing everything the right way. And he had a pretty serious accident. And was in the hospital the first time for 9 weeks, was in a wheelchair for several months, back in the hospital again. Of course, this did not slow down the wedding plans at all, and because we got to keep everything on track. And of course, at that point, we had told everyone we were getting married, and there were all sort of mixed attitudes about that, but we stayed on track. And a year to the day after this accident, he managed to limp down the aisle, and we got married. And before that, though, somewhere in there, I started noticing that there was something that wasn't quite right about the types of partying that we were doing and the some of the things that were going on. As I said, he was in a pretty serious accident. And, of course, lots of times serious accidents, as this one did, involved a lot of medication and a lot of rehab, a lot of stuff. And I could see a pattern here that I did not like. And when the pain was unmanageable for him, he would drink a lot. And I don't mean like we'd go out with a bunch of friends, and he would drink a lot alone. And I didn't have any experience with that type of drinking. I didn't know what it was about, but I knew that it changed his personality and that it was very difficult for us to get along. And so at some point, about 4 months before we were to be married, I said, this isn't going to work. Something's got to change here. I don't want to live like this. And you need to get help. And so he said, okay. And so he decided that, I didn't know anything about treatment centers, so he went to the psych ward. So I took him to the hospital and checked him in the psych ward. And the next day, his psychiatrist that had been assigned to him, called me and said, you and I need to have a talk. So I went to the hospital, and we sat in a family waiting area, and he told me that there was absolutely nothing wrong with my fiance, nothing. That I was the one with the problem, and that how dare I? What kind of person that loves somebody would issue an ultimatum like that? I won't marry you unless you get help. And I mean, he just let me have it. And I felt that big. And I thought, okay, well, he's a doctor. So he would know, right? He would know. This is something that I did. That I have some part in this. And what I see and think is real, maybe isn't really real. And so I took my fiance home. And we got married. And things got better for a while, and then they got worse for a while, and they got better for a while. I was working. He was going to school because he'd been on one of those co-op programs, you know, where you work a semester and go to school. And so I was working, and he was going back to school full time. And I would notice things like I'd get up in the morning for work, and he'd been up studying late. But he was asleep on the sofa, and there was a bottle of liquor on the table that I hadn't seen before. And he graduated, and that really concerned me because at that point, my father-in-law had passed away. And he'd passed away from the disease of alcoholism. And that was the first time that I ever saw what that disease can do to a person. He was a wonderful man. He was kind and gentle, and the disease took him out. And I didn't understand that, but it did frighten me a little bit because I was starting to watch my husband drink in a way that didn't look right to me. You know, it didn't look like, oh, let's go have a good time kind of thing. So he graduated, we moved to Tampa, Florida. And I can remember being in Tampa, we didn't know a soul. And one night after work, he came home really late, and he started talking to me about going to this room with all these old men. And he went to see what it was all about, but he had decided it was not for him. I had no idea what he was talking about. No idea. I don't even remember if he used the words AA or Alcoholics Anonymous. I know now that that's where he'd been. Something told him to go check that out. And he did, and he decided it wasn't for him, and it just was completely off my radar. So we moved back to Birmingham, and we started the whole, you know, married thing, kids, the house, the cars, the jobs, you know, and all that stuff. And I was working really, really, really hard on staying on that track that I had created in my head, that, you know, that Donna Reed and all that stuff, okay? And the drinking was still there. You know, there was always a bottle in the freezer. And I would buy a bottle of wine, you know, so I could have a glass of wine when I wanted. And, you know, a week later after I bought it, put it in the refrigerator, I'd go to get a glass and, you know, open the bottle and get, there was no bottle of wine. No bottle of wine. At one point, I decided that if I was going to be able to have a glass of wine when I wanted it, I was going to have to hide the wine. So that was what happened at our house, was I hid the wine, he didn't hide the liquor. The liquor that he had was out in the open, but, you know, whatever I wanted was hidden. But, you know, that kind of went on. And I never thought about it being alcoholism. Because, you know, we had a job, we had, you know, and in my head somehow I had this picture that alcoholism looked like, you know, someone who lives under a bridge and drinks out of a paper bag. I had no concept of what this was about. But it got a lot worse for him, even when I didn't realize that it was getting a lot worse for him. You know how we do, we sort of get in our own little, we put our blinders on and we go on about our own little way. And I was telling somebody today, I had someone tell me the other day, if I don't go over there, I can pretend that they're sober. And I think I kind of did that because I didn't understand it. I knew there were a lot of things that were not going on well at home. I felt completely inadequate to do what I was doing. I felt completely alone because I didn't want anybody to know on the outside what I was feeling and seeing on the inside. And I did a really good job of keeping up that thing on the outside. And as a result, that meant that I had created a prison for myself, really, where I could just stay in that spot and nobody would have to know how screwed up I was. I had tried all the self-help books. I mean, you know, a smart person, you go to the store, you get the books, you go to the library, you get the books. If you read it, they tell you what to do. And they never told me what to do. If they did, I couldn't see it. And I just kept trying to, you know, with the tools that I had accumulated, a lot of them which were really not very good tools, I tried to keep doing what I thought I was supposed to be doing. We took a vacation to Disney World, and we took the kids to Disney World. I'll have to tell you, that was by far the worst vacation I have ever been on in my life. And we would spend, you know, you spend those 10 hours around Disney World dragging the kids around. And you know, he was always ready to go, you know, does everybody need something to drink? You know, he'd disappear and he'd come back and everybody would have their Cokes. And we'd get back at the end of the day and I'd be trying to get kids who were exhausted, you know, cleaned up and in bed. And I'd come out and I'd open the mini bar and there's nothing left in it. And I can remember sitting there on the little tram thing, you know, where you wait and the tram picks you up to take you. And I looked at him and I said, I will never, ever go on a vacation with you again as long as I live. And we got home and this is when we went through the, I can prove that I don't have a problem because I can go without drinking for 30 days. I don't know what that's like for the people on the other side of the room, but I can tell you what it's like for those who are living with you while you're doing it. It is not a pleasant experience. And it was, we had gone to Disney World on Thanksgiving, so this 30 days was between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Okay, it's not fun going with somebody to parties, you know, when you have to go to all the office parties and everything, and they're counting. They're like, okay, 17. Okay, it's been 18 days. I only have, and that's kind of how we, you know, that went, and 30 days was up, and we were good. Everything was going to be new and different. It wasn't 2 months before I was sitting in a chair opposite this person in front of the fireplace one evening, and I sat there and listened to how I was the problem, and it was my fault. And if I did this better or that better or whatever better, this wouldn't be this way. And once again, I believed it. I was turning my power over to somebody else. That's all I'd ever done. That's what I knew to do. I believed that there was a God out there, but I sure didn't act like it. I would turn somebody over and put them up there as my higher power if I thought they were going to like me like that. I didn't think anything about it. And so it didn't matter what I thought. I didn't even know what I thought. If they told me that was true, and I didn't have some kind of obvious proof, I believed them. The disease progressed rapidly. And really and truly, in like 6 months, it was done. And I had taken my children and some friends to a lake place, and he called me every day telling me how he was sick, and I didn't want to hear it. And I was so glad I was someplace else, because, you know, I didn't have to turn that power over when I could hang the phone up. And I don't know how I knew that. It just happened. And so finally one day, after about 3 days of that, he called and he said, "No, I need real help. I want you to take me to treatment or something." And I said, "Well, you'll have to wait your turn, because I got 5 kids out here that have, they're already on my agenda." And I was so proud of myself. And I took the kids, and of course they don't know anything that's going on, because that's part of my job, is to protect them from, you know, real life. And we had this agenda, and I go out and I get in this boat, and I crank up the boat, and we back the boat up from this dock, and we're like 30 feet away from the dock, and the boat dies. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out, okay, I got these kids, and it's just right here. It's not like I'm very far away. One of the kids is hysterical. He's crying, you know, like he's, you know, on Gilligan's Island or something. And I'm like, you know, we can see the dock. We can swim to the dock. So my oldest son and his friend get out, and they swim over the dock, and they pull the boat back up, and, you know, we mess with it, and we get it going. Still not getting this. So we take off in the boat, and we get out, and, you know, I think we spent an hour and a half trying to help some kid figure out how to ride one of those knee board things. But I'm doing my mom thing, you know, I'm doing my thing. And the boat dies again. And this is in the middle of the week. There's nobody out there. And this time we are in the middle of the water. I mean, in the middle of the lake. So, you know, we get resourceful. And finally, this man pulls up in a fishing boat, and he's going to tow us off to the side. And I don't know what happened, but the boat started, and I thought, okay, I get it. I don't know what this is about, but I think I'm supposed to go home, put the boat up, and go home. And so I did, and took him to a treatment center that had been recommended by a psychologist friend, and got there, and, oh, they were so worried about him. They checked his blood pressure, you know. And I'm sitting there going, if you can just take him off my hands, for right now, we'll be okay. But at the same time, I was thinking somewhere in here, but what about me? What about me? What about all this stuff I'm dealing with? What about me? On the outside, I was thinking and hearing, well, you don't count. And on the inside, I was like, but I'm still here. I'm still here. Well, I don't know anything about the treatment center. They kept him about 10 days, but I do know that he found someone there that came to that center that introduced him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came out of that treatment center and he was on fire. He was on fire. He was going to meetings every day and he was talking about sponsors and he was never home when we were supposed to be getting kids ready for bed. Sober or not, he was not there. And all these people that didn't have last names were, you know, his new best friends. And he was getting these ideas about how maybe he needed to quit his job and do something different. And I was like, I've just gone from the frying pan into the fire. What is this? But then he got a new sponsor. And his sponsor started telling him, your wife needs to go to Al-Anon. So he started, on top of all this, he's coming home and telling me what I need to be doing. I need to be going to Al-Anon. I know now that he was trying to share with me what he had gotten out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's sure not what it sounded like then. It sounded more about putting me in my place and telling me what to do and making sure that he was driving the train. And then his sponsor's wife started sending him, giving him these as the bookmarks, you know, the Just for Today bookmarks and stuff. And they would show up on my bedside table. You know, I'd get the kids ready for bed and finally get my face washed, and I'd come in and there'd be this new little bookmark or something on my bedside table. And I'm reading this stuff and going, you know, this is nuts. So finally he said, I want you to go with me to a meeting. They have an Al-Anon meeting at the same time. I want you to go with me out to Hoover to this meeting. And I was like, fine. I was like, okay, fine. If, you know, if he'll leave me alone, I'll go to this meeting. So I get there. It was on a Sunday night in Hoover. And they don't have an Al-Anon meeting on Sunday night in Hoover. And I got there, and it was an open AA meeting. And I sat there, and I'm thinking, see, I told you. I don't need to do this. It's not for me. If I was supposed to do this, see, there's not even a meeting here. And I sat there and I listened to all these people, you know, share whatever it was they were talking about. And at that open AA meeting, I don't remember much of it because mostly in my head I was thinking, see, I don't need to be here. I don't need to be here. And after the meeting, this woman came up to me and she had this little needlepoint book. And she said, I'm so glad you were here tonight. And I'm sorry there wasn't an Al-Anon meeting, but we have a meeting on Thursday nights, and I hope you'll come back. This program saved my marriage. And I looked at her and I went, thank you. We got in the car and I went home. And I thought I was done. But those things kept showing up on my bedside table. And so about 3 or 4 months later, my husband announced to me that his mother was coming to babysit the kids so that I could go to a meeting with him in Vestavia. And he knew that there was a meeting because it was directly across the hall. And that was his home group. That AA group is his home group. So I thought, okay, I'll go 6 times. I don't know why 6 is a magic number, but it was. I'll go 6 times and prove that I do not need to go sit in a room with these people who are going to sit there and they're all going to talk and whine and complain about how bad their life is. And like, I don't have enough going on that I got to go listen to them too. And that's what I had. That was the picture that I had in my head of what was going to be there. But anyway, I went, and I made a commitment to go for 6 weeks. I'm not sure when I moved from the back row to the front row, but I'd been there more than 6 weeks. And about the second or third time I moved from, after I'd moved from the back row to the front row, this woman sat down next to me that I'd never seen. And she'd obviously been there, going there for a long time, and she patted me on the knee, and she looked at me, and she said, so how are your steps going? What? You know, I'd been just soaking in what everybody was saying in the general discussion meeting, and I'd been hearing the steps, but I hadn't been paying any attention to that. I didn't have a newcomers meeting or anything like that. I'd heard the term sponsor across from people across the hall, but I really didn't know how that pertained to us. I didn't know about any of that. So at that point, I started thinking that I needed to start paying better attention to what was going on in there. And then I was there one night, and my husband was doing the coffee, and, you know, you have to be there an hour early because it takes that long for it to cook. And I'm pacing up and down, and they had started a beginner's meeting at like 7:30 before the meeting, regular meeting started. And these people all came into this beginner's meeting, and they're all sitting there, and I'm thinking, well, I don't know who was supposed to be leading the beginner's meeting, but they're late. Finally, the person who was supposed to be leading the beginner's meeting gets there, and I said, you've got a whole bunch of people in there. And she said, well, why didn't you go help them? And I said, what? I said, oh, no, I'm new in the program. She said, then you know how to be a newcomer, don't you? It's like, well, yeah, I guess. So I went in there and sat with her while she did her meeting. A couple of weeks later, this man that was chairing the meeting came up to me after the meeting. He said, oh, by the way, you have the topic next week. And I said, I don't have the topic next week. He said, yeah, you do. I'll put you down on the thing. I said, I can't do the topic next week. And he said, why not? I said, well, I'm new. And he said, I don't care. And I said, oh. I said, I don't have a sponsor. And he said, I don't care. And he walked off. So my name was on the form, and, you know, being the good Al-Anon person that I am, I had to do that. So I got all the books, you know, and I went home, and I worked for a whole week on the topic. It was on forgiveness. And I sat there at the table, you know, behind the thing, and I was so profound, you know. Had my little thing and did my thing, and then I let everybody, you know, go around the room. And there was that woman. She came to the same meeting. She came to that Monday night meeting, too. She's sitting back there on the back row, still got that needlepoint book in her hand. And she starts talking. She starts sharing. And she's talking to me. And I'm thinking, well, I have the program. Why are you talking to me? I really was not getting it. I was there. I was taking up a seat. I kept coming back. But I really, really wasn't all connecting. Somewhere it was, or I wouldn't still been there. Very soon after that, I decided that if I was going to keep coming here, I was going to have to look like I knew what I was doing. And I'd heard that to do that, I was going to need a sponsor. But I didn't know how you found a sponsor. So one night, you know, I started praying about it. Because that's what they told me you're supposed to do, so I did that. And I went to a meeting, and they had a meeting on sponsorship. And so I sat there real quiet, and I listened, and this woman who'd been around, I'd seen her around. I knew she'd been there a long time, too. And she started talking about what she made her people that she sponsored do. You know, this is the list. And I was like, she's off the list. And I'll have to tell y'all, what you laugh now, she was my first grand sponsor. Didn't know that at the time. I picked my sponsor, and guess who her sponsor was? God, you know, does for you what you can't do for yourself. After I got a sponsor, I started working the program. I started working the steps. And somewhere in there, I discovered that part of my problem was I wasn't teachable. And I had to accept that I wasn't teachable, and that until I became teachable, my life was not going to be serene. It wasn't going to be peaceful. And so with the help of my sponsor, my guide, I came to discover that there was someone out there that could teach me if I was willing. And so I had to get to the part where I was willing to let that teacher lead the way. And the teacher and my guide told me that I had to take stock of what I had. And I had to accept whatever was in my bag or in my stockroom. That's what I had. That's what it was there.
So I was given a job to do, so I did it to the best of my ability. I went and I took a list of what was in my stock room. I had to have a lot of help from a teacher. I had to have a lot of help from that higher power. And I had to have a lot of help from my guide, because my inventory list looked like, you did this wrong, you did this wrong, you did this wrong, you did this wrong. That's all I could see. I couldn't see the whole person. I was still in the same, I was still, you know, in right or wrong. My first sponsor at one point looked at me when I was working on my fourth step, and she looked at me and she said, okay, you're not allowed to use the words right or wrong for a whole week. And I thought that was just the dumbest thing in the world, but I learned a lot in that week about myself and about how I looked at everything as black and white, no choices, no gray areas, nothing. And it really did help me take that inventory. I had already learned by being in the rooms of Al-Anon that anonymity had a lot of value. It wasn't just about nobody else knowing that I was there. I think in the beginning that did help me feel safe. But the biggest part about that I had begun to learn was that I took up the same amount of space as everybody else in the room. I wasn't up here and they were down here, and I wasn't down here and they weren't up here. We were just all taking up the same amount of space. And I'm glad I had learned to believe that before I had to get to my fifth step, because it made it a lot easier for me to trust that whatever I said was whatever I said. Whatever I had was whatever I had, and that that person wasn't going to love me any less because. And I had never had that experience before, and I had never believed that that was a possibility before. So I did that, and then when I got through, my sponsor said, well, now you know what you got. Learn to live with it. I was like, what? No, I mean, I thought we were going to get rid of all this stuff I don't like. And she said, not up to us. So I got to become willing to let God take the things that I didn't use or didn't need anymore. And I'd been around a little while doing this. It took me a long time to do all this. I'd learned how to do something else that I had never known how to do, and that is wait. I'd learned that wait is a verb. That means it is an action. And I never saw wait as an action. I always saw wait as inaction. And in this case, that's what I needed. That was the verb I needed. That was the action I needed to take, was to wait. And that God would reveal to me what I needed to do next. And when that was time, I knew it, and I said, okay, take what you need. I guess you're going to leave the rest. And so then I went to my sponsor, and I said, okay, what do I do now? And she said, well, you know all that stuff you had in that storeroom that was, like, out of date and all that stuff? Yeah. Well, you're going to have to figure out how you messed up relationships with that stuff. And I said, okay. And then you get to go make amends. It's like, oh, well, you know, mostly everybody's harmed me. She said, yeah, I know. And so we began that process. And it wasn't nearly as scary as I thought it was going to be. I was actually able to see things I hadn't seen before and accept that, you know, I had what I had, and I'd been where I'd been, and that if I wanted to move forward, I was going to have to accept that and do the next right thing, and that was to go to those people and to do my part in making those relationships, mending those relationships. And it took all sorts of different forms, and but it was a very liberating experience. And then I got to start doing all of that stuff on a daily basis. And good part of it I'd been doing on a daily basis. But now I've learned when I have something that, when I'm not in a good place, I know that I got to go back to the first step and work all the steps on whatever it is and figure out what my problem is. I've been through a couple of sponsors. I've, as they say, I've worn out a couple of sponsors. I have learned so many things in this program, not just through working the steps, but you know, that 12th step about carrying the message to others. That's why I'm here today. Someone asked me to do this, and so that's why I'm here. I've had a lot of experience. You know, those of you who have come to Al-Anon probably had a similar experience, that once you started understanding the disease of alcoholism, I've discovered that they're everywhere. I mean, they are everywhere. I mean, I didn't know it, but when I started going to Al-Anon, I had an uncle that had been in AA for 35 years. And he's still in the program. And I love it now when we see each other, we get together, and immediately we're all there, we're over there by ourselves, you know? And it's great because we immediately, we're, you know, talking the same language. My mother-in-law passed away 5 years ago from the disease. Indirectly from the disease. She was a wonderful person, and we were very, very close. And it took me a while to recognize that she had that disease too. I have a sibling that he can't find it. He's been in and out the doors of AA, and he's just not there. And I get to give him to a higher power and know that my higher power will take care of that however it's supposed to happen. And that whatever, however it turns out, my higher power is going to take care of me and all that too. I was telling somebody before this that part of that watching the disease in my brother is also watching the disease in my father and the effects that it has on him. And I get to, I'm sort of standing on the outside seeing how the whole family disease really works. And all that I can do with that is share my experience, strength, and hope when it's asked for, and give them both to my higher power. And you people are the ones who've showed me how to do that. I was thinking when Mary was talking last night about how the people in the program have come to her rescue so many times. And about 2 years ago, I was on the phone with my husband, and he told me he wanted a divorce. And while he was talking to me on the phone, on my cell phone, I had just gotten out of the shower, so I'm standing there half-dressed, and I'm on the phone, and one of the women that I sponsor is trying to call me on my cell phone. And for about that long, you know, I'm listening to what he's saying instead of answering the phone. And I was standing in the kitchen, and the house phone was on the wall. And that same sponsee called me on the house phone. And I said, I can't talk to you right now. I've got a sponsee calling in. And I hung up the phone. And I picked up the phone, and she said, hey. And I said, hey. She said, are you okay? And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, where are you? I said, well, you just called me. I'm in my kitchen. She went, oh, yeah. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I was on the phone with my husband, and he just asked me for a divorce. And she said, I'll be there in 10 minutes. So I went and got dressed, and finished drying my hair because it was like half wet, and half, you know. And she came in the door, and she said, first thing she did after she hugged me was said, have you eaten today? And it was about noon, and I said, well, no. She said, get in the car. So we went to the Publix, and we walked around, and she put things in my hand, and we went and sat on her porch. And she just let me just sit there. And then later, she said, what are you going to do now? I said, well, I guess I'm going to go home. She said, okay. So I said, why did you call me? And she said, oh, I'll tell you about it later. I said, okay. So the next day, when I was talking to her, I found out that we had another friend who was getting ready to undergo some pretty serious surgery. And that's what she had called to talk to me about. And I just went through the motions. And the next morning, she called me and she said, you need to get in the car and you need to meet me at this person's house. They're having a complete come apart. I said, okay. So I drove over there, and this friend of ours was terrified, absolutely terrified, and understandably so. And she kept saying, I can't do this by myself. I can't do this by myself. And we were saying, you're not doing this by yourself. You never have to do anything by yourself. And she had no idea what I was doing, but she had no idea what she was doing either. And that was that God was giving me an opportunity to be in the 12th step, because that's what helps me take care of me. And of course, she did just fine, and we were all there, and she didn't have to do anything alone. I think that there are so many gifts that this program has given me. I really don't know where to start. The first thing is that I have a higher power now that I never had before. I believed that there was a God out there, and I believed that that God would take care of people. I just didn't know that I was one of them. And some days I question that. But I know that it's true, because I've lived it. I've had the gift of being able to live that and know that my higher power is there. I've been given the gift to be somebody that I like most of the time. And when I don't, I've been given the gift of a whole lot of people that let me call them on the phone so they can help me work that out too. I have learned that humility is not humiliation. And I've learned that caring is not the same as caretaking. And I've learned that I don't have to do anything by myself. I've learned that I have lots and lots of choices with everything that comes up in my life, and that one of the choices is that I don't have to do it by myself. That I have a higher power that's always on the ready, and that I have an entire cell phone full of phone numbers of people that will call, that will come and help me, or listen to me, or talk to me about it, anything, anytime. I was thinking this morning that if you had told me 20 years ago that I would be standing in a room full of people telling them any of this stuff, I would have looked at you like you were from Mars. If you had told me that I would learn how to give to other people only what I have to give, and that would make them happy, I wouldn't have believed you. I don't have anything except what I came here with today. I don't have any story that's any different than what I came here with today. I have what my higher power gave me. And you people have showed me that not only is that okay, that's just the way it's supposed to be. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And if you told me that 15, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have believed you. I just wouldn't have believed you. Thank you all for letting me do this. Thank you for letting me have an opportunity to learn something else today, because that's what I get as a gift from this program every day, is an opportunity to do something new. Thank you.